The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Publication of Louise Penny's 18th Chief Inspector Armand Gamache novel, A World of Curiosities, readers are invited to return once again to the fictional village of Three Pines, the setting of the long-running series and now a TV show available on Prime Video. For many, it's a place they can't get to fast enough. I talked to Penny recently on the What Should I Read Next podcast about the writing life, the stunning success of her series, and why readers continue to gobble up the Gamache books just as fast as she can write them. When Penny was initially shopping her debut novel, Still Life, to publishers before its 2005 publication, she was told readers would never be interested in a crime novel set in Quebec. How wrong they were. Readers can't get enough of Three Pines, finding comfort in returning not only to beloved characters book after book, but to the village itself, with its snug boulangerie where Sarah bakes crusty loaves fresh each morning, Myrna's bookshop that smells of tea and flowers, Olivier's bistro where endearing eccentrics gather to banter or argue over mugs of café au lait or glasses of evening scotch. Penny may have drawn inspiration from real places, but Three Pines is fictional, even a touch magical. In the world of the books, it's a known curiosity that the village doesn't appear on any maps and is only ever found by people who are lost. That hasn't stopped scads of devoted readers from flocking to the eastern villages of Quebec to see and experience a version of village life for themselves. Why is everyone reading Louise Penny? Three Pines holds a magnetic pull for readers, despite the fact that terrible things happen in and around the village, and happen fairly often, given Penny's publication rate of a book a year. The books are, after all, murder mysteries. By her own description, they are proudly and specifically crime novels. The series follows the investigations of the supremely decent, quietly intelligent, startlingly kind Chief Inspector Gamache, head of homicide for the Sûreté de Québec. His job may be to investigate murders, but at their heart, Penny's books are not primarily focused on crime. Her whodunit plotlines serve as a springboard to explore the mystery of human nature, an approach that grants the stories a satisfying depth and psychological astuteness. Penny's novels shine a light on the best and worst of humanity, exploring love and friendship, belonging and loneliness, goodness and evil, the stuff of life that matters deeply, not only to the Three Pines residents that populate her stories, but to readers everywhere. And if she does it in a way that keeps us turning the pages, saying just one more chapter long after bedtime, so much the better. A common question with any long-running series is, where does one begin? In other words, must you begin at book number one before you can enjoy book number 18? Penny told me no. It would be unfair to demand readers read 17 books to earn the right to read the new one. That's why every book is intentionally written so it can serve as an entry point into the series. Good news for Three Pines newcomers. A World of Curiosities is particularly hospitable to those meeting Armand Gamache and his fellow villagers for the first time. In this new release, a brother and sister with a tragic past return to Three Pines after a long absence. Many years ago, their mother was brutally murdered, and Penny reveals that it was this case that brought Gamache and his protege, Jean-Guy Beauvoir, together. She takes us back in time to their first meeting and the ensuing investigation that left both feeling uneasy. Now, more than a decade later, the siblings' reappearance resurrects painful memories for Gamache and Beauvoir, and rattles the community, already on edge because of a series of recent murders in the area. Longtime Gamache readers will appreciate how the newly revealed origin story adds layers to the two's history. New readers will benefit from meeting the pair at the beginning of their relationship. Regardless of where you choose to begin, these series highlights will give you a sense of what to look forward to upon entering the world of Three Pines. Number one, Still Life. In the idyllic village of Three Pines, people feel such a sense of safety that they don't even lock their doors. When a beloved local woman is found in the woods with an arrow shot through her heart, the locals assume it's a tragic hunting accident. But Three Pines resident and Sûreté de Québec Chief Inspector Armand Gamache senses something is off and probes to discover what really happened in those woods and why. A stunningly good first novel and a tantalizing series opener with more of a slow burn than her subsequent works. Number 2, A Rule Against Murder, book number 4. Because a small village can realistically only absorb so much murder, Penny sends Gamache away from Three Pines for his murder investigations roughly every other book. In this installment, Gamache and his wife, Renee Marie, retreat to the luxurious Manoir Bellechasse to celebrate their anniversary, only to find that the wealthy, cultured, and absolutely unbearable Finney clan has descended upon the place for an ill-tempered family reunion. When somebody turns up murdered, it's obvious to all that the killer must still be at the manor. If you enjoy mysteries with a close circle of suspects, you're going to love this one. Number 3, The Brutal Telling, book number 5. In the opening pages of this installment, a stranger is found murdered on the floor of Olivier's bistro. Olivier and his partner, Gabri, claim they don't know the victim, but it quickly becomes clear to Gamache that that's not the whole truth. Three Pines residents are forced to confront the unthinkable. Could the murderer really be the man who tends the hearth of the bistro, the symbolic heart of village life? Thomas Hobbes said that hell is truth seen too late, Louise Penny wrote on Goodreads. That's the vortex around which the brutal telling swirls. Number 4, Bury Your Dead, book number 6. My personal opinion, the series moves to the next level in the 6th installment, in which Penny brings the riveting plotline she's hinted at in previous books front and center. Plus, it's set during Winter Carnival in startlingly beautiful Quebec City, which, upon reading Penny's lavish descriptions, you will want to visit immediately. Gamache is there not to revel with the celebrants, but to grieve an investigation gone horribly wrong. Retreating to the city's snug literary and historical society for rest and research. But then a historian is found murdered in the basement. Number 5, How the Light Gets In, book number 9. A missing celebrity, a fatality at the Champlain Bridge, a Sorette in turmoil under corrupt leadership. Folks may be feeling festive in Three Pines as Christmas draws near, but Gamache's world is in chaos. This book, which takes its title from a Leonard Cohen lyric, adroitly balances the baffling murder investigation of an elderly woman with the excruciating drama gutting the Sorette and Gamache's own inner circle from within. Number 6, A Great Reckoning, book number 12. When an old map showing Three Pines is found in the walls of Olivier's bistro, the villagers are at first intrigued by the curiosity, particularly because Three Pines, as a rule, doesn't appear on maps. But then the map is implicated in the murder of a Sorette professor, a murder seemingly committed by one of their own. Even Gamache himself is a suspect. The investigation leads the former head of homicide to devastating secrets, ones whose truths he is afraid to uncover. Number 7, A Better Man, book number 15. There's a lot happening in this 15th book. A pregnant woman goes missing during a record-breaking flood. The Sorette itself is in turmoil thanks to ongoing corruption and power struggles, and Gamache makes a terrible decision. Readers relish seeing poet Ruth Zardo in her role as fire chief and artist Clara Morrow as she faces a pivotal career decision after critics skewer her new show. By introducing new characters and challenges, Penny deftly sets the stage for a new set of plot lines we'll see unrolled in later books. Number 8, All the Devils Are Here, book number 16. Louise Penny plus Paris sounds like a match made in heaven, but the title smacks of hell. It's drawn from The Tempest. Hell is empty, and all the devils are here. While Gamache's visit to the City of Lights is tainted by murder most foul, the litany of Parisian landmarks employed in these pages is pure delight for the reader. We visit neighborhood bistros, fancy hotels, patisseries, the Paris archives, the Eiffel Tower, and the garden of the Musée Rodin. Our next article by Wadzani Moot is titled, Oprah's 99th Book Club Pick is Here. Oprah's first book club pick of 2023 is officially here. Her pick? Bittersweet by Susan Cain, a nonfiction title that explores how we deal with sadness. not by denying it, not by surrendering to it, but by acknowledging it. Even if at times it seems self-defeating, because we're all supposed to be happy, right? Kane joined CBS Mornings on February 15th for the announcement and explained why achieving a richer form of happiness means acknowledging both the bitter and the sweet. This book has the power to transform the way you see your life and even the world, Oprah said of the book. I've started to look at my own life and the world differently. If we realize that all humans know or will know loss and suffering, we can turn toward each other, Kane writes. We're never going to love or even like the bad things that happen to us, but the more we see it all as part of life, the more we can get to the richest form of happiness we can possibly know. Kane is the author of the best-selling Quiet, which has been translated into 40 languages. Her most recent TED Talks have been viewed more than 2 million times. We'll continue the discussion about bittersweet in the next article by Susan Kane, titled Read Oprah's Favorite Chapter from Her New Book Club Pick, Bittersweet. In this adapted excerpt from Oprah's Book Club's 99th selection, Susan Kane reveals what happens when we lose love, how we can mourn it, and how we can survive. One of my earliest memories, first afternoon of kindergarten, age 4, I'm sitting at a kidney-shaped table, coloring blissfully. Yellow Crayola for a bright sun, green for the grass below, between them a blue, blue sky. I glance up and there's my mother, standing with the other moms at the back of the classroom, waiting to take me home. She smiles her loving, endlessly patient smile, and I fill with joy. To me, it's as if she wears a ribbon circling her curly red hair. To me, it's like being picked up from school by an angel and following her home to the Garden of Eden. Throughout my childhood, she was like this, ready after school with a dish of chocolate ice cream, happy to chat about fourth grade social life, always present with a gentle joke or when things went wrong to soothe tears. My siblings were much older. My father was a medical school professor who worked long hours. I loved them dearly, but my mother was everything. Did a better, more loving mother exist anywhere on earth? That would have been impossible. All my friends said I was lucky to have a mother like her. She made chicken soup and pot roast and lit candles on Friday nights. She rarely raised her voice except to encourage things I said and wrote. She had taught me to read and write when I was 3. I soon claimed the floor under the card table as my workshop, and there, crouched beneath the tabletop, produced plays, stories, and magazines on lined paper stapled together. We didn't know back then that this act of writing would tear us apart, and I didn't know how complicated my mother actually was. She was an only child. Her own mother had been very ill throughout my mother's childhood, lying in bed for years, facing the wall. What would it have been like? What might it do to you to see your mother's back turn day after day, year after year? My mother was convinced that she'd done something horribly wrong to make her own mother so sick, and tormented by an insatiable desire to be seen. My mother's father was a rabbi, loving, wise, and twinkly, extremely devoted to his daughter, but mired in heartache. In 1927, at age 17, he'd come from Eastern Europe to Brooklyn on his own to get married. Only a decade later, when my mother was 5, he'd called her to the radio to hear Hitler speak. "Listen, Mamel," meaning little mother in affectionate Yiddish. My grandfather told her as the Führer's clipped stentorian tones invaded their narrow sliver of a dimly lit kitchen. "This is a very bad man. We have to pay attention." Soon the bad man had killed his mother, father, sister, aunts, uncles, and cousins back in Europe, every single person he ever had known and loved. In public, my grandfather lived a vibrant life dedicated to his congregation. At home, the air in their one-bedroom apartment was heavy with his sighs. The tragedies that surrounded my mother became part of her. Later, they became almost all of her. She was consumed by feelings of fear and unworthiness, but she managed to hold them at bay when I was a child. Looking back now, I see the signs of what was to come. How she panicked if I wandered steps away at the supermarket. How she forbade many normal childhood activities, climbing a tree, riding a horse, that she deemed too dangerous. How she said that she loved me so much that she would, if she could, wrap me up in cotton. She meant this as an expression of love. I understood that it was also a prison sentence. From an early age, we also stood on opposite sides of the fault line of religion. My mother raised me as an Orthodox Jew. No driving, TV, or phone calls on Shabbat. No McDonald's, no pepperoni pizza. But it never stuck. One of my earliest memories is surreptitiously watching Scooby-Doo on mute on Saturday mornings. Another is eating bacon, profoundly unkosher, deeply delicious bacon, on a school ski trip. This was partly because my family was a confusing grab bag of influences. On the one hand, my beloved grandfather, the rabbi, and my mother, the staunch loyalist. On the other hand, my father, a tacit atheist whose gods were clearly science and literature. Also, I was born a skeptic. To this day, if you say X, I automatically think, what about Y? As an adult, this tendency is intellectually useful, though sometimes it drives my husband bonkers. As a girl, I couldn't see why we should keep kosher in the name of a god I doubted was real. But the real conflict between my mother and me didn't start until I was in high school, when the minor restrictions of childhood gave way to an ironclad code of chastity. No suggestive clothing, no unsupervised time with boys ever. My mother even watched as I got my hair cut, chastising the hairdresser if he styled the angles too provocatively. Theoretically, the rules were religious and cultural in nature, but their real function was to serve as an anchor to keep my ship docked in my mother's harbor. When I followed the code, the ship rocked gently in her lapping waves. When I deviated from it, her gale-force anger tore us both to smithereens. By American standards of the 1980s, I was polite and responsible and a little too straight-laced. But invariably, I would break the rules, wear the wrong clothes, make the wrong friends, attend the wrong party, and panicked, hostile accusations would follow. Waves of anger, floods of tears, days then weeks of stony silence. During these wordless eternities, it was as if all love had drained from my soul. My stomach churned, I couldn't eat. But the weight I lost was nothing compared to the emotional hunger and the guilt I bore for making my mother so sad. My friends were bewildered when I reported these conflicts and the depths of my reactions to them. To them, I seemed, and probably was, the most rule-abiding girl in school, got the highest grades, didn't smoke or do drugs. What more did my mother want? "Why don't you just say you're sleeping at my house," they would say, if we wanted to stay out late one night. They couldn't understand that my mother and I were so close that she could read my face more accurately than any lie detector test, or that the rules in my house were different from theirs, that to break them was not to commit an adolescent transgression, but to destroy my mother's fragile psyche, that if only I would do the right thing, my mother, whom I love more than anyone and anything, would be happy again. And so would I. Since neither of us could stand being separated, after each traumatic rupture, we always reconciled. The nurturing mother of my childhood always returned to me. We would hug, shed a few tears. I would lower myself gratefully into her warm bath of love and comfort. With each reunion, I believed the war was behind us, but it was never behind us. Over time, I learned to mistrust the ceasefires. I started to approach our house after school with a stomachache, grew skilled at gauging her mood the moment I entered. I felt I mustn't do anything to upset her equilibrium or trigger her rage. I became more aware of her childhood sorrows and of her present gaping maw of emptiness. I started to dream of escape, of the day I'd be free of her. But I also longed to stay. She was still my mother, and I wanted desperately, more than I've ever wanted anything before or since, to fill the chasm inside her, to take away her hurt. I couldn't think of my mother's tears, which I often caused, without crying myself. As the youngest child, I mattered so much to her. I mattered too much. I mattered like the sun. To grow up was to condemn her to darkness. Back then, I still believed that there must be a way out of this conundrum, that somehow, if I did everything right, I could find a way to be myself and still make her happy, the way I'd once done so effortlessly during my childhood. All through college, the telephone in my dorm room linked me inescapably with my mother. At first, when it rang, it was merely incongruous, her voice on the other end beaming in from the distant planet of childhood. She wanted to know if I was happy. She wanted to know if I was adhering to the code, which, of course, required saving your virginity until you married one of your own. Uneasily, I weighed these rules against the strapping young men at school who devoured bacon cheeseburgers after crew practice. To my mother, it went without saying that such classmates were off limits, but to me, they were irresistible. My mother sensed all this. She was sure I'd get pregnant, ruin my reputation, and die of AIDS before graduation. As freshman year wore on, she felt every inexorable step of my separation from her. She became increasingly distraught, the way you would if you truly believed that your daughter had agreed to be devoured by a monster. If in high school we'd followed a repeating pattern of separation and reunion, now the mother of my childhood had simply vanished. In her place was a vengeful woman who telephoned daily with accusations of malfeasance, who stood for hours at my bedroom door during college vacations, threatening that if I didn't wise up, she'd pull me out of school so she could keep an eye on me. I was terrified, not so much by the loss of the degree as by the prospect of living again under my mother's watch. Had she been struck down at that time by a tin-wheel truck or a swift and incurable disease, I would have been one part relieved and three parts devastated. And for this, there would have been funeral rituals, there would have been a language for the pain, a way for others to understand it. As it was, it never occurred to me to mourn her. Who would think to grieve a mother who was pulsatingly alive and daily appearing, Gorgon-like, at the other end of a dorm room telephone? Instead, I confided my shameful desires in my journals, filling notebook after notebook. I wrote that I loved her, but also hated her. I wrote in excruciating detail about all the forbidden things I was doing at college. I wrote of my dawning realization that the mother I adored, who adored me, was not dead but gone, and possibly had never existed in the first place, that I was motherless in some existential way. In short, I recorded all the things I couldn't tell her in real life because I knew that to share them would have been emotional matricide, and in this way, I made it through freshman year. And now we come to the part of the story that you might have trouble believing. All these years later, I can't believe it myself. It was the last day of the school year. For some reason, I can't recall, I needed to stay on campus for a few extra days, but to send my belongings home. My parents arrived to help with my bags. We greeted each other in my empty, echoing dorm room. I felt ill at ease that my parents didn't belong here, which only reminded me that neither did I. The car loaded, we said goodbye, and that's when it happened. Without having planned it, without conscious awareness of the implications, I handed my diaries to my mother. Handed them to her. Unthinkingly, as an afterthought, I asked her to take them home for me, for safekeeping, I said. For safekeeping, I believed. The story I told myself at that pivotal moment was that she was still the angel of my childhood, the mother who would never do anything wrong, like read someone's diary. Even if that someone handed her that diary for safekeeping. But of course, upon handing her that stack of notebooks into which I'd inscribed the story of our great love and its traumatic unraveling, I'd chosen to sever our relationship. It's painful for any parent to hear what their teenager really thinks of them. For my mother, it must have been unbearable. As indeed she testified when I got home the following week and she stood at my bedroom door holding my journals and miming a guillotine blade across her neck. I felt that she was right. I felt that I was, in some psychologically true point of fact, my mother's killer. Childhood will always end, but these weren't the ordinary pangs of adolescence. For the decades after I gave my mother my diaries, we still talked on the phone, still saw each other at holidays, still said I love you and meant it. But she haunted my dreams, appearing in different guises as a sometimes menacing, sometimes fragile protagonist to whom I was yoked, someone I loved yet longed to escape. In waking life, we circled each other, warmly but warily, many of our conversations still fencing matches, best concluded quickly. I didn't trust her, and she didn't trust me. I learned to keep my distance, to have stronger boundaries, to understand our not altogether uncommon situation, in which the parent tells the child that she can be herself or be loved, but she can't be both, in which the child believes that if only she agrees never to grow up, she'll be loved forever. Often the child conspires with this agreement, until one day she doesn't. It took me a very long time to forgive myself for breaking my end of the bargain. It took me even longer to do emotionally without a mother. But I learned to deal with having grown up this way. My tendency to avoid conflict, distrust my own reality, defer to others with stronger opinions. There was one me who marched to her own drummer, who followed her own true north, as I'm constitutionally inclined to do. And there was the other me, who surfaced during times of discord, who assumed that other people's interpretations of events must be correct and should naturally trump mine. I've come such a long way. I'm still working on it. I'll always be working on it. But for a very long time, even after my life had moved on and even soared, even after I had a home of my own, a family of my own, in so many ways, the vibrant life I dreamed of as a child, even then I couldn't speak of my mother without tears. I couldn't even say a simple thing like, my mother grew up in Brooklyn without crying. For this reason, I learned not to speak of her at all. The tears felt unacceptable. It made no sense to grieve a mother who was still alive, even a mother as difficult as mine. But I couldn't accept the chasm between the mother I remembered, who'd been my greatest companion, champion, and love, and the one I had now. Yet that childhood mother, if she'd ever existed in the first place, had walked away with the diaries I handed her on the final day of freshman year, and it was, for all intents and purposes, the last I ever saw of her. I'm telling you how I loved and lost my mother, but not because of the particulars of my story. Your stories of love and loss, of bitter and sweet, are different. I'm acutely aware that they might be much more traumatic, but hopefully less so than this. But I decided to share this story because whether you consider it a small loss in the scale of the world's sufferings, or a big one because mothers represent love itself, I know that you've lost loves of your own, or you will. And it took me decades to understand the events I just described, let alone to heal mostly from them. Maybe I've learned something that could be of use to you. We're taught to think of our psychic and physical wounds as the irregularities in our lives, deviations from what should have been, sometimes as sources of stigma. But our stories of loss and separation are also the baseline state, right alongside our stories of landing our dream job, falling in love, giving birth to our miraculous children, and the very highest states of awe and joy, wonder and love, meaning and creativity, emerge from this bittersweet nature of reality. We experience them not because life is perfect, but because it's not. What are you separated from? What or whom have you lost? Did the love of your life betray you? Did your parents divorce when you were young? Did your father die? Was he cruel? Did your family reject you when they discovered your true sexuality? Do you miss home or the country of your birth? Do you need to hear its music to fall asleep at night? How are you supposed to integrate this bitter with your sweet? How are you supposed to feel whole again? To these questions, there's an infinity of answers, but here are three. One, these losses shape your psyche. They lay down patterns for all your interactions. If you don't understand them and actively work to form new emotional habits, you'll act them out again and again. They'll wreak havoc on your relationships and you won't know why. Two, no matter how much therapeutic work you do, these may be your Achilles heels for life. Maybe a fear of abandonment, a fear of success, a fear of failure. Maybe deep-seated insecurity, rejection, sensitivity, precarious masculinity, perfectionism. Maybe hair trigger rage or a hard nub of grief you can feel like a knot protruding from your otherwise smooth skin. Even once you break free, and you can break free, these siren songs may call you back to your accustomed ways of seeing and thinking and reacting. You can learn to block your ears most of the time, but you'll have to accept that they're always out there singing. The third answer is the most difficult one to grasp, but it's also the one that can save you. The love you lost, or the love you wished for and never had, that love exists eternally. It shifts its shape, but it's always there. The task is to recognize it in its new form. You hurt because you care. Therefore, the best response to pain is to dive deeper into your caring, which is exactly the opposite of what most of us want to do. We want to avoid pain, to ward off the bitter by not caring quite so much about the sweet, but we can't have one without the other. My mother told me constantly, ever since I was a child, that the days my siblings and I were born were the best days of her life, and I believed her. I still believe her. Everything is broken. Everything is beautiful. Everything, including love. Our next article is Take the Bittersweet Quiz and See Where You Fall on the Sensitivity Scale. How in tune are you with the combination of sadness and happiness in everyday life? Find out your sensitivity with this diagnostic from Susan Cain, author of the 99th Oprah's Book Club pick Bittersweet, research scientist David Yetten, and cognitive scientist Scott Barry Kaufman. Grab a pen and ask yourself these questions, filling in your level of agreement on a scale from 0, not at all, to 10, completely. And remember, there are no wrong answers. Number 1. Do you tear up easily at touching TV commercials? Number 2. Are you especially moved by old photographs? Number 3. Do you react intensely to music, art, or nature? Number 4. Have others described you as an old soul? Number 5. Do you find comfort or inspiration in a rainy day? Number 6. Do you know what the author C.S. Lewis meant when he described joy as a sharp, wonderful stab of longing? Number 7. Do you prefer poetry to sports, or maybe you find the poetry in sports? Number 8. Are you moved to goosebumps several times a day? Number 9. Do you see the tears in things? This phrase comes from Virgil's Aeneid. Number 10. Do you feel elevated by sad music? Number 11. Do you tend to see the happiness and sadness in things all at once? Number 12. Do you seek out beauty in your life? Number 13. Does the word poignant especially resonate with you? Number 14. When you have conversations with close friends, are you drawn to talking about their past or current troubles? Number 15. And this, do you feel the ecstatic is close at hand? To score yourself, add your responses and divide that total by 15. If you scored between 0 and 3.8, you're a cheerfully optimistic sanguine type. If you scored between 3.9 and 5.7, you're beautifully balanced, able to move easily between sanguine and bittersweet states. If you scored between 5.8 and 10, you're a true connoisseur of bittersweetness, the place where light and dark meet. Note, while the exploratory pilot studies conducted by Yadin and Kaufman assessed preliminary aspects of the items, they didn't yet include other ways of validating them, such as focus groups, expert review, and larger sample exploratory and confirmatory factor analysis. They encourage interested scholars to conduct more research on the survey items to further ascertain their psychometric properties. Our next article by Joanna Rakoff is titled, The Moment I Knew the Man I Truly Loved Wasn't My Husband. The author of My Salinger Year describes the moment when she faced up the truth of her feelings and began a more authentic life. One night, not so very long ago, I walked into a bar and found, as if he had been placed there just for me, the most handsome man in the world. He sat on a low couch surrounded by women, not in the style of a cinematic playboy holding court over his admirers, but in the manner of a very different sort of handsome man. The man whose attraction lies in his absolute inner peace, his ego's egg-like self-sufficiency. This man did not need the attention of the women surrounding him, and thus he possessed it completely. But in truth, I barely noticed the women. All I could see was him. His slender legs bent upward in a V, too long for the trendily low sofa, his mouth, which was full, turned upward just slightly in a smile. What did he look like? Does it matter? I suppose it does. A stranger might have presumed him foreign, Italian perhaps, or Spanish, or from some unspecified corner of South Asia or the Middle East, due as much to his close-cut, dark, elegant garments as his olive skin and hooded eyes and curling black hair, rapidly fading to white at the temples. And his hands. His fingers. Long, elegant. He held a glass of clear liquid that I suspected, no, I knew, to be pure water. Water unadulterated, even with ice. I spotted him at first out of the corner of my eye as I walked from the entrance of the bar to its rear, looking for the friend I'd planned to meet for a drink before heading out to a party. I wore a new dress, two layers of black silk, high-necked, long-sleeved, cut close through the shoulders and waist, a dress I'd bought for this party at which I'd see friends from all over the country, friends I loved and missed, friends who formed the emotional scaffolding of my life. But now, in the face of this man, the importance of the party, the dress, my friends, fell away. The entire world fell away, except for him. For a moment, I stared at him, my hands shaking, heart hammering. Icy water soaked through my boots, stiffening my feet with cold, but the rest of my body swelled uncomfortably with heat. Under my arms, my silk dress clung damp with sweat. For a moment, the room spun, and I braced myself on a nearby sofa. I had, I realized, been holding my breath for a murderous amount of time. When I turned my face back toward the man, now laughing at something uttered by the woman to his left, his face glowing with delight, I also realized there was a word that was transpiring in my body. Desire. The bar, I should explain, comprised the lower lobby of a large hotel in downtown Boston, adjacent to a sprawling convention center. 14,000 riders had converged for an annual conference, despite the terrible storm sending wind across Boylston Street in painful swirling gusts and crusting the pavement with ice. Across the street, in another large hotel, my children sat with their father in a dim, anonymous room, propped against a plush headboard, eating room-service chicken fingers and watching an animated movie. That afternoon, my husband and I had taken turns registering for the conference and looking after the children. For this was how we lived our life, separately. I had, over the course of our marriage, contemplated a life apart. For years, it was all I contemplated. The day after our wedding, I called my mother in tears and whispered, "I've made a mistake." She sighed as if she had expected this call and said, "Well, you've made your bed. Now you have to lie in it." 15 years later, as my children changed into their soft pajamas, I swiped on mascara and lip gloss and slipped my new dress over my head, reaching around awkwardly to pull the zipper from my spine to my neck, for I did not ever, ask my husband for help with anything, and certainly not something as intimate as zipping up a dress. Quickly, I kissed my children goodbye, filled for a moment with an intense, animalistic desire to sink into bed with them, to fall asleep with their warm faces buried in my neck. Instead, I pressed on through the deserted, overbright lobby, leaned forcefully onto the glass door made heavier by the wind, and carefully made my way across the street, slipping and sliding in my kidskin boots, sleet burning my cheeks. Suddenly, I felt almost giddy, elated with excitement. I was alone, obligated to take care of no one but myself for the evening, soon to be in the company of friends. These annual visits bolstered me for the entire year that followed. At the second hotel, a gust of wind propelled the door open, thrusting me into the warm lobby, dimly lit and lined with low sofas, one of which, of course, sat him. For a moment, sick with shock, I turned back toward the door, toward my children. It was not too late. I could race back across the street and sink into sleep with their heads on my shoulders. My life was not a terrible one. I had learned, by willing myself to learn, how to comfortably lie in the bed I'd made. Instead, I turned my eyes back toward the handsome man, and as I did so, he turned his eyes from his rapt companions and toward me. For a moment, he stared at me, his mouth open, his eyes astonished. Then he shook his head as if clearing the remnants of a bad dream, and in a clear, deep voice, a voice choked with emotion, called out my name. 23 years earlier, I'd hugged my parents goodbye, stepped into the hallway of my freshman dorm, and found a boy walking toward me. Tall, long-limbed, so thin his jeans hung precariously on his frame. His loose t-shirt bore no band name, no team logo, no political slogan, no signifier of how he defined himself. "Hi," he said. His hair, a depthless black, lay close to his head, but I could see that it was as curly as mine, that it would grow wild and enormous if not tightly shorn. A beard lined his wide jaw and round, wire-rimmed glasses, this being 1990, covered his eyes, large and dark, with heavy eyelids that gave him a sleepy, bemused effect. "Hi," I responded in a voice I did not recognize, for something was shifting violently inside me, as if I were letting out a breath I'd been holding my whole life. I wanted to rest my head on his chest and close my eyes. I wanted to bury my face in his neck. I wanted to sit down and listen to him talk forever. It would be years, decades, before I realized that there is a name for this phenomenon. Love at first sight. His name was Kirill, derived not from the common Russian name Kirill, but from the appellations of his parents, who took three letters from each, Rene and Frank, to form a new one. Its singularity seemed somehow a metonym for Kirill himself, for there was, it seemed, no one even remotely like him in the world. He was a composer. This was how he introduced himself, as if it were perfectly normal for 18-year-olds to already possess a vocation. And from that moment, we became fast friends, a mirthful unit during the absurd icebreakers of orientation. Over the years that followed, I called him, to anyone who asked, one of my best friends, though we largely saw each other when our paths crossed in the mailroom or the quad or a dining hall. Each time it felt like we were picking up a conversation we'd left off 5 minutes before, as if our whole friendship were one long-running, endless discussion. Our final year, I ran into him hours after returning to campus. The joy I felt on seeing his face felt akin to nothing I'd experienced in my life so far. "What are you doing now?" he asked. "Heading into town to buy a new bike," I said. "The old tenants left a bike in my house," he responded. "It should fit you." In his room, I said, "I missed you," my voice breaking, and he put his arms around me, after all those years, and kissed me, and the world suddenly shifted into perspective, as if everything that came before this moment had been a mere blur. This, I realized, was what a kiss was supposed to feel like. This was why people liked kissing. But also, decades later, this is still hard for me to say. I wanted him, in a way I had never, not ever, wanted anyone before. Every encounter that preceded it had stemmed from some boy's desire for me rather than mine for him. I felt purely grateful to be wanted. My own desire had never even factored into the equation. After graduation, I moved to London for grad school. I, too, now had a vocation, writing. I suppose I'd had it all along. I'd published my first poems in second grade, but had been too afraid to admit it. Kirill stayed on campus, completing his classes and applying to doctoral programs. In January, he would join me. Though I believed myself to be having a grand time, seeing plays, laughing in pubs with classmates, wandering through the Tate alone, when Kirill showed up on the doorstep of my shabby student house, I collapsed into his arms, sobbing. Together, we moved to a lovely apartment, taught ourselves to cook, saw operas at Covent Garden, and spent hours gazing at Sargent's in the National Gallery. We were happy, deliriously so. But there was one catch. I could no longer write. The deadlines for my seminar papers came and went as I stared at the ornate moldings on our ceiling. I had also, more troublingly, lost all desire to compose poems and stories or even scrawl in the journal I'd kept since first grade. I couldn't think either. In the fall, I had bubbled over with ideas. Now I sat in silence, listening to my classmates argue. My mind no longer seemed my own. In March, Kirill got into Berkeley, the premier program in his field. This was not a surprise. There had been no question that he would get in, and now there was no question that I would join him. He did not ask me to come. He simply presumed I would, as did I. In June, I sobbed again when he went back to the States to find us an apartment in California, clinging to him as he stepped into his taxi. But a day or two later, something happened. I resumed writing. My overdue papers, my master's thesis, came easily to me. I filled my journal with thoughts and ideas and observations. As I walked around Hampstead, stories unfurled in my head, and I raced home to type them up with cinematic urgency. Why couldn't I write? Why couldn't I think when I was with Kirill? What did this mean about him? Or about me? Or about us together? I did not go to Berkeley. I went home, to New York. At first, I told Kirill and myself that I would be there soon, but I found reason after reason to delay. I'd gotten a job as a PA on a Barbra Streisand film. My friend Deborah was getting married. My parents needed help around the house. Somehow a year passed, then another. Somehow I had a boyfriend, then another. From opposite coasts, Kirill and I wrote to each other, first on paper, then email, about his frustrations with academia and the rarefied world of classical music, and my job in publishing and the column I began writing for a magazine. At night, sometimes I came home from a party or a date and sat down at my desk, hoping to find a note from him, longing for his singular take on the world. I missed him, dreadfully. Missed him in all ways. Sometimes, as I lay in bed at night, I found myself quivering with longing for him, burning for his touch, for the sound of his voice in my ear, the specific warmth of his head resting on mine, his arms around me. Why did I not return to him? Why did I not, like a Nora Ephron heroine, race to the airport, buy a ticket at the counter, fly out to Berkeley, and show up at his door? At the time, I believed that I had lost him, that I had hurt him so badly he could never forgive me. I believe, too, that this, my abandonment of Kirill, was the greatest mistake of my life, a tragic error for which I needed to suffer for the rest of mine. But I know now that I feared my love for him occluded every other want and need of my life. I feared that if I returned to him, I would be defined forever purely as his wife, the helpmate to his genius. And so I married someone else, a man I barely knew. Perhaps because he, a would-be poet himself, saw me, first and foremost, as a writer, and a talented one. I can envision a life of him, with my work at its center, a life in which I woke up and wrote, and fell asleep with my head on the page, my hand gripping the pen. Perhaps because I didn't love him in that all-encompassing way, there was no danger of losing myself. Years passed, a decade. Kirill won fellowships and awards and commissions that took him all over the world. I stayed in New York and wrote, struggling to lie in the bed I'd made, intent, for reasons that now elude me, on presenting my marriage, myself, to friends, to the world as perfect, as normal, as happy. Kirill married too and moved to Paris, then Illinois, then Boston to teach. Sometimes he'd come to New York for a commission or a performance, and we'd see each other every day, taking long walks through Central Park, eating long lunches at quiet restaurants, my body slowly igniting. Sometimes on the bench of a subway car or seated next to each other on a friend's couch, I let my head rest on his shoulder, overcome with longing. Sometimes he read an essay of mine in the Times and called overcome, I see now, with longing. Sometimes we went months, years without speaking to each other, terrified of the feelings that would arise at the sound of the other's voice. Sometimes we spent hours on the phone day after day talking about everything, every single thing in our lives, a practice that alarmed and enraged our spouses. They knew we were not having an affair, virtual or otherwise, but the truth, I suppose, was more frightening. One cold afternoon just before Thanksgiving in 2010, we lingered over lunch for hours, then walked and walked around the West Village. I think we shouldn't be in each other's lives anymore, he said, sadness lending his voice an odd formality. It's just too sad. I want to be with you, but I don't want to have an affair with you, and I don't want to destroy your family. I nodded, unable to speak, for I knew if I opened my mouth, no comprehensible words would emerge, simply cries of rage and frustration. 2 years later, I walked into a bar in Boston, never guessing that a few months later this would be my home, and found myself in front of the most handsome, most attractive man I'd ever seen. Every night since we'd parted, I dreamed of him, his long body next to mine, and yet for an instant, I still thought him a stranger, the most handsome stranger in the world. Across that room, he saw me and stood up, shaking his head in disbelief. "Joe," he called in his low, quiet voice. It occurs to me only now that I could not have heard him, as the bar thrummed with voices and music and the clanking of glasses, but that I merely saw his lips move in the shape of my name. And I found the courage to move toward him rather than run away, run back to my children and husband until, as in my dream, I was in his arms. The world, as it had 20 years earlier, fell away. "How are you?" he asked. How was I? I truly did not know. I thought of my children snuggled together under the heavy duvet and the afternoons we spent wandering through museums or turning cartwheels in the park. I thought for a moment of my tiny office and the happy hours I spent there, lost in the worlds of my characters or teasing out the thread of an argument. I thought, too, of the panel on which I was scheduled to appear the next day, which had seemed exciting and important an hour earlier, and now struck me as absurd and trivial and devoid of meaning in the face of Kirill, as did everything. I wanted to take his hand and go wherever he took me. "How are you?" I asked, and watched his full mouth grow slack with pain. "I'm not good, Joe," he said. "I can live without you, but I can't be happy without you." I don't need to explain, I suppose, that the same was true for me. Excerpted from Wanting, Women Writing About Desire, published by Catapult. Joanne Rakoff is the author of the international best-selling memoir, My Salinger Year, and the best-selling novel, A Fortunate Age, winner of the Goldberg Prize for Fiction and the L. Reader's Prize. Her writing has appeared in the anthology Wanting, Women Writing About Desire, The New York Times, The Guardian, O, the Oprah Magazine, Vogue, Elle, Porter, and elsewhere. And her new memoir, The Fifth Passenger, is forthcoming from Little Brown in 2024. Our next article by Cassie Hurwitz is titled, Tyler Perry is Donating $2.75 Million to Atlanta Homeowners. Tyler Perry may be known for his work in Hollywood, but he's also a dedicated philanthropist. Case in point, Perry is donating $2.75 million to older homeowners in Atlanta who are at risk of losing their homes. The homeowners he's helping are seniors with fixed incomes who can't afford the increasing real estate taxes and stand to lose their homes if they can't pay. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports that Perry will pay the back property taxes, including city, county, and school taxes, for these homeowners, 300 of them to be exact. Beyond that, Perry has pledged to continue his help in the years to come. If taxes increase over the next 20 years, Perry will cover that amount for 100 homeowners. He has already helped the residents by donating $750,000 to cover the first year of back taxes and increases, and then will give an additional $500,000 each year for the next 4 years to cover more increases. Perry has long been a fixture in the Atlanta community. In 2019, he built a 330-acre movie studio there, and the complex also includes a shelter for women and LGBTQ+ youth. He's also been known to cover payments at random. He once left a $21,000 tip for employees in an Atlanta restaurant, and even spent $430,000 so Walmart shoppers could afford their Christmas presents. Oh, and Perry once paid Cicely Tyson $1 million for one day's work in his movie, Why Did I Get Married? In an Instagram post, Perry shared the article from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and explained in a caption how his studio has changed the value of the surrounding homes and that he won't stand for residents losing out because of it. So, I knew that the success of my studio would affect all the property values around it, But make no mistake, the seniors on fixed incomes around the studio will not lose their homes because of past due or rising taxes, he wrote. We ain't doing that to our legacy. According to Forbes, Perry ranks third on the list of the world's highest paid entertainers, and we can celebrate the fact that he's using much of that wealth to help others. We'll end this week with some quotes to jumpstart your morning. Just like the days, no two sunrises are ever the same. Jonathan P. Lamas. It was a morning like other mornings, and yet perfect among mornings. John Steinbeck from The Pearl. Don't predict the condition of the entire day by the state of the morning. You don't judge a book by its cover. A cloudy morning is no guarantee for a rainy day. Israel Moore Ayavor from The Leader's Watchwords. Starting the morning without prayer is like starting a car without gas. Todd Stalker from Dancing with God, First Year Thoughts on the Loss of My Daughter. By the state of the morning. You don't judge a book by its cover. A cloudy morning is no guarantee for a rainy day. Israel Moore Ayavor from The Leader's Watchwords. Starting the morning without prayer is like starting a car without gas. Todd Stalker from Dancing with God, First Year Thoughts on the Loss of My Daughter. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.